pains just to turn the screws on you? Gods be gracious, how much more pressure could I possibly apply? I believe you'd do anything if you wanted your hooks in me bad enough. Locke wiped his lips with the back of his hand, and Jean could see that his spit was blood-tinged. I know a thing or two about revenge, and you have powers I can only dream of, so I must believe you'd do anything.
Why bother when I could have your real name any time I wanted it?
Now that's so much arrogant bull.
It would simply be a question, Patience continued, of how long you could watch Jean Tannen suffer before you would beg for the privilege of telling me.
You're no different than the falconer, said Locke. Same fucking... Locke, said Jean very loudly. Attitude toward... Yeah? Kindly shut the hell up, said Jean, enunciating every word as though teaching the phrase to a small child for the first time. Locke's slack-jawed stare was gratifying. She's right, continued Jean, unable to keep a growing excitement out of his voice. If your true name was all she wanted, why not torture me? I'm compromised. I'm bloody helpless. It would be quick and simple, so why aren't I screaming right now? Because if these people were any good at quick and simple, the falconer would have killed us back in Camor. No, damn it, think harder. Because you have such a sweet and innocent face? Because if she doesn't want your real name the easy way, then she has some other motive. Sweet dancing donkey shit, Jean! Locke rolled back toward Patience, but closed his eyes and rubbed at them. She wants me to stick my own head in the noose of my own free will. Get it? She wants me to step off the cliff. Cut my own wrists so she can gloat, humiliate. Locke broke into another severe coughing fit, and Jean sat down on the bed and pounded gently on his back. The rhythmic movement did nothing good for Jean's collection of fresh aches and bruises, but it calmed Locke rapidly.
What we're discussing, said Patience, is employment, not compulsion. Credit me with enough wit to recall the fate of Luciano Anatolius and Maxillan Stragos. Coercing you two never seems to work. We're willing to trade service for service.
Patience, said Jean, can you really get rid of this poison? Can you do it without using his real name?
If we hurry, yes.
If you're lying, said Jean, if you're leaving anything out, I'll try to kill you again. Understand? I'll give it everything I have, even if it forces you to slay me on the spot. Patience nodded. Then let's talk business. Let's not, snarled Locke. Let's show this bitch to the door and refuse to be puppets. Shut up. Jean pushed firmly down on Locke's shoulders, foiling his attempt to roll out of bed. Tell us about this job. Locke drew in a rasping breath to spew some more damn-fool craziness. Jean, with the reflexes that kept him alive when blades were drawn, clamped a hand over Locke's mouth before he could speak and pushed his head back down against his pillow.
I can't agree to anything on Locke's behalf, but I want us to hear your proposal. Tell us what the job is.
It's political, said Patience.
Oomph, oomph! Said Locke, struggling in vain against Jean's arm. Oomph, fucking, oomph.
He wants to hear more, said Jean. He says he's very excited to hear the whole thing.
2. I need an election adjusted.
How adjusted?
As a cautious estimate? Patience turned to the window and stared out into the rain. I need it rigged from top to bottom.
Government affairs are a bit beyond our experience, said Jean.
Nonsense. You'll feel right at home. What is government but theft by consent? You'll be moving in a society of kindred spirits.
What sort of election are we supposed to be mucking about with here?
Every 5 years, said Patience, the citizens of Carthane elect an assembly, the Conseil. 19 representatives for 19 city districts. This dignified mess runs the city, and I need a majority of their seats to go to the faction of my preference.
This is what you want us for?
Locke finally slipped Jean's hand aside and managed to speak. My dead ass!
With your powers, you'd have to be out of your god's damned mind to settle for anything Jean and I could pull off. You could wiggle your fingers and make them elect cats and dogs, for fuck's sake.
No, said Patience. In public, the Magi stand completely aloof from the government of the city. In private, we are forbidden to use any of our arts. Not on the poorest citizen of Carthane, not for a single vote.
You won't use your sorcery on the people of Carthane, said Jean. Not at all.
Oh, Carthane is our city, through and through. We've adjusted everything to suit our needs, and that includes the inhabitants. It's this contest we can't touch, the election itself.
Seems awkward as all hell. Why the limitation?
You've seen some of our arts. You opposed the Falconer. You survived Tal Verar.
In a manner of speaking, muttered Locke.
Imagine the society of men and women where those powers are universal, said Patience. Imagine sitting down to dinner with 400 people, each of whom has a loaded crossbow set beside their wine glass. Some very strict rules will have to be enforced if anyone wants to live long enough to see the last course.
I think I get it, said Jean. You have some sort of rule about not shitting where you eat?
Magi must never work magic against one another, said Patience. We're as human as you are, as complicated, as insecure, as driven to argument. The only difference is that any one of us, out of the mildest irritation, could make someone evaporate into smoke with a gesture. We don't duel, she continued. We don't so much as tease one another with our arts. We forcefully separate ourselves from any situation where our crossed purposes might tempt us to do so.
Situations like this election, said Jean.
Yes, we do need to control the Conseil, one way or another. Once the election is over, the new government becomes a general tool. We adjust its members by consensual design. But during the contest itself, when our blood is up, we need to keep our arts entirely out of the situation. We need to be pure spectators.
Patience raised both of her hands, palms up, as though presenting two invisible objects for weighing.
There are two major factions among my people, two major parties in Carthani politics. We battle by proxy. Each side is allowed to choose agents, enterprising individuals, never magi. We set them loose to fight on our behalf. In the past, we've favored orators, political organizers, demagogues. This time, I've convinced my people to hire someone with a more unusual portfolio of achievement.
Why? Said Jean.
Some people play handball, said Patience, smiling. Some people play catch the duke. This is our sport. The election diverts much of the frustration our factions come to feel for one another and brings prestige to the side that backs the winner. It's become a highly anticipated tradition.
I've imagined you people must run the show in Carthane, said Locke. I just never would have suspected this. What a joke on all the poor saps lining up to vote every 5 years.
They get an orderly city regardless of the winner, said Patience. In Carthane, nobody empties the treasury and vanishes. Nobody holds grand masks every night while the streets fill with night soil and dead animals. We see to that.
Would a city of puppets really give a damn if you didn't? Said Locke, wheezing. He cleared his throat. You want us to work fraud in the service of order and public sanitation. What a thought!
Isn't theft theft? Aren't lies lies? Isn't this exactly the sort of opportunity you'd spend years chasing if it was your own idea? Besides, the job serves you as much as anyone. Accepting it will save your life.
How long would you need us? Said Locke.
The election is in 6 weeks.
What about resources? Clothes, money, lodging?
We have complete identities prepared for you. All possible comforts and a large pool of funds to dispose of on business.
Only business? Said Locke.
You'll be treated luxuriously for 6 weeks. What more could you want?
Perelandro's balls. A little incentive to win would be nice.
Incentive? Life itself isn't sufficient? You'll be well-dressed. You'll recover your health. And you'll be in a greatly improved position from which to resume your career. If you win, our gratitude might easily extend so far as comfortable transportation to the city of your choice. And if we lose, you can't expect us to reward failure. You'll still be free to leave, but you'll do it on foot.
I can only speak for myself, said Locke, and Jean's heart sank. I meant what I said. I have no idea what your full powers are. I don't trust you. I don't trust this situation, and I have no reasonable chance to catch you if you're lying. If you're not sincere, this is a trap, and if you are sincere, it's some kind of bizarre pity fuck.
All the years you might have had coming? All the things you have yet to do?
Spare me. You're not my mother. If Jean will take the job, you won't find a better man anywhere. He can do anything I could, and he's better at keeping himself in one piece. Thanks for coming all this way to entertain me, but leave me alone.
Hold on, Jean began.
I'm disappointed, said Patience. I would have thought you had at least one more thing to live for. Can you honestly say you've never hoped for any chance of a reunion with Sabatha? Somewhere out there in the...
You go fuck yourself, snarled Locke. I don't care what you think you know. That's one subject you don't get to presume anything about.
As you like. Patience flexed her right hand, and Jean noticed the gleam of silver thread woven between the fingers. It seems I've wasted our time. Shall I expect you in Carthane when your friend is dead, Jean?
Hold, said Jean. Patience, please, give us time to talk, in private.
Patience nodded curtly and moved the knuckles of her right hand. Light shifted on the silvery gleam of her cat's cradle. Jean blinked, and in that instant thread and woman alike vanished into thin air.
Great, said Jean. Fucking magnificent. I think you finally managed to really piss her off.
Nice to know I still have the knack, said Locke.
Are you really, truly out of your god's damned mind? She could save your life.
She could do a lot of things.
Take the chance, Locke.
She's up to something.
What a revelation! What an amazing deduction! I'm sorry, remind me again what your other options are.
She wants something from me, damn it, more than she's letting on. But she's already got everything she can take from you, right? You said it yourself. If she's out to get you, she'll get you. But if she does right by you, then you'll be in a strong position to move on.
It works that way for both of us.
I won't be that witch's toy, said Locke. Not for all the money in Carthane. She's not human. None of them are.
Jean glared coldly at Locke. He lay under Patience's cloak, his wild aspect incongruous next to the fine oilcloth. A cornered animal, preparing to die, huddled under delicate material worth several years of a skilled laborer's life. The whites of his eyes were turning pink.
Patience was right, Jean said quietly. She has wasted our time. You'll die choking on your own blood. Today, tomorrow, doesn't matter. And you'll be so happy with yourself, because somehow dying has become an achievement.
Jean, wait!
Wait, wait, wait!
The resentments and frustrations of the past few weeks seemed to boil up as Jean spoke. The old familiar temper, snapping like a rope frayed down to a single strand, the rage like a hot pressure under his skin, pulsing from his skull to his fingertips. Only it was worse than usual, because there was nothing he could hit. Zodesti, Cortessa, Jean would have snapped their bones like badly fired pottery. Patience, even. He would have gone for her throat, dared her sorcery. But with Locke, he was limited to words, so he weighted them with scorn and let fly.
What the hell have I done but wait? Wait on the boat to see if you got sick. Wait here, week after week, watching you get worse. Day and night, chasing any hope this fucking city could offer, while you...
Jean, I'm telling you, every instinct I have says this is a setup.
No shit. And since we know they mean to use us, why can't we use them as well, for everything we can get out of the deal?
Give me up, Jean. Let me go and their fun vanishes. Then they'll have that much less reason to play you false.
Oh, marvellous. Fucking masterful. You'll be dead, and they'll be inconvenienced. Maybe even mildly disappointed. What a worthy trade. Like slashing your throat just before your opponent can take a piece and catch the Duke. But shut it. Just shut it. You know, when you're healthy, you'll laugh the gods right in their faces. But when you're convalescing, sweet hell, you are a miserable bastard.
I've always admitted...
No, you've never admitted this. You don't stand still, Locke. I played along in Tal Verar when we talked about retiring on our money. But that was bullshit, and we both knew it. You don't retire. You don't even take holidays. You move from scheme to scheme, jumping around like a spider on a hot skillet. And when you're forced to stand still, when you don't have a thousand things going on to keep you distracted from your own thoughts, you actually want to die. I see that now. I'm so god's damned slow and stupid, I see it for the first time.
What the hell are you talking about?
You and I, in the boat, after we torched the glass burrow, after we killed Bug's murderer. Do you remember what we talked about? What you were like? And Vel Verazzo. You tried to finish the Grey King's work by drowning yourself in wine. Now this. You're not just cranky when you're ill, Locke. You have the... Look, it's called Endlichtgelaben. It's a Highvadran word. I learned about it when I was studying as an initiate of Azaguia. It means, death love, death desire. It's hard to translate. It means you have moods where you absolutely want to destroy yourself. Not as some self-pitying, idle notion either, as a certainty. For Paralandro's sake, Jean, I wouldn't want this if I had a fucking choice. You don't want it up here, said Jean, pointing to his own head. You want it somewhere deeper, so deep you can't recognize it. You think you've got some logical, noble excuse for showing patience the door. But it's really that darkness inside, trying to fuck you over once and for all. Something has you so scared you're seeing everything backwards.
What is it, then? If you're so smart, what is it?
I don't know. Maybe patience can read thoughts like a book, but I sure as hell can't. However, I can tell you what the hell I'm scared of. Being alone. Being the very last one of us standing. All because you're a selfish, stubborn coward.
Not fair, wheezed Locke.
No, it isn't. A lot of good people have died to bring you this far. You keep this shit up, and you'll be seeing them soon. What are you going to tell Carlo and Galdo and Bug? Chains, Nazca.
Jean leaned over and all but whispered his next words down at Locke.
What are you going to tell the woman I loved? The woman who burned so you could have the slightest chance in hell of even being here in the first place?
All the faint color left in Locke's face had drained out. He moved his lips but seemed unable to convince any words to get that far past his throat.
If I can get up and live with that every god's damned day, then so can you, you son of a bitch.
Jean stepped away from the bed.
I'll be outside. Make your choice.
Jean, call her back.
Are you just humoring me?
No, please. Call Patience back.
Are you ashamed?
Yes. Yes, how couldn't I be, you ass?
And you'll do it? Whatever it takes, whatever Patience requires to keep you alive.
Get her back in the room. Get her back! By the gods, I need her to fix me so I can punch your guts into soup.
That's the spirit. Patience!
Jean yelled, turning toward the apartment's door.
Patience, are you?
Of course.
Jean whirled. She was already in the room, standing behind him.
I didn't say I was going far, she said, cutting off his question before it was spoken. You'll both do it?
Yes, we'll...
There are going to be some conditions, interrupted Locke.
Damn it, Locke, said Jean. Trust me.
Locke coughed and shifted his gaze from Jean to Patience.
First,
I want it clear that our obligation to you begins and ends with this election. That's our side of the bargain in full. No hidden surprises, no snake-bite, double-dealing, bondsmage bullshit.
I beg your pardon, said Patience.
You heard me.
Locke's voice was still hoarse, but to Jean it seemed infused with genuine strength, or anger, which was as good for the time being.
I don't want one of you people popping out of my ass 5 years from now and implying that I'm still on the hook for having my life spared. I want to hear it from you, right to our faces. Once this is done, we don't owe you shit.
What a high art you've made of insolence, said Patience.
If that's the game you feel you have to play, so be it. Service for service and a clean severance, just as I said.
Good. I want another privilege, too.
Our side of the bargain is already exceptionally generous.
Who do you think you're haggling with, a fucking pie vendor? If you'd rather lose your election...
State your request.
Answers. I want the answer to any question I ask, when I ask, to the best of your ability. I don't want you to wave your hands and give me any bullshit about how great and terrible and incomprehensible everything is.
What questions?
Anything. Magic, Carthane, yourself, Falconer. Anything that comes to mind. I'm tired of the god's damned shadow dance you people call conversation. If I'm going to work for you, I want you to explain some things.
Patience considered this for some time.
I have a private life and a professional life, she said at last. I may be prepared to discuss the latter. If you fail to respect the former, you will earn consequences.
Good enough.
Locke wiped his mouth on his tunic sleeve, adding new blood to old stains.
Okay, Jean. Do you still want the job?
Yes.
Good, said Locke. I do too. You've hired us, Patience. Now do your thing. Get this shit out of me.
I can't work here, said Patience. We'll need to move, and quickly. A ship is waiting at the docks to take us across the Amethel. Everything I need is on board.
All right, said Jean. I'll go out and call her.
Patience snapped her fingers, and the outer door fell open. A carriage was waiting on the street outside, its yellow lamps glowing softly in the drizzle, its quartet of horses standing in silent readiness.
Aren't you theatrical as hell? Said Locke.
We've lost enough time taming your pride, Locke. We need every moment we can steal back if you're going to survive what comes next.
Hold it, said Jean. What do you mean, survive what comes next?
It's partly my fault. I waited to approach you. I should have done it before you had a chance to start kidnapping physicers. Now Locke's condition is worse than precarious, and this would be hard enough for someone in perfect health.
But you... Stand down, Jean. It's the same hard sell we use, said Locke. Astonishing promises first, important disclaimers second. Just get on with it, Patience. Do your worst. I'm pissed off enough to take any sorcery you can throw at me.
Jean must have said something very interesting to shame you into finding your courage again.
Patience clapped her hands, and two tall men strode in through the front door. They wore broad-brimmed hats and long black leather coats, and carried a folding litter between them.
Keep that shame burning if you want to live.
Patience touched Locke briefly on the forehead, and then she beckoned her coachman over to roll him onto the litter. Jean watched warily but let them handle the work alone, as they seemed steady and careful enough.
The only thing I can promise with absolute certainty, said Patience as she watched this delicate process, is that what I need to do when we reach the ship will be one of the worst things that's ever happened to you.
Interlude. The Boy Who Chased Red Dresses. 1.
You're still angry with me, said Chains.
It wasn't a question. Locke's attitude would have been plain to someone with the empathy of a shithouse brick. A day had passed since the affair of Sabatha's capture, and while Locke had rapidly shrugged off the effects of his fall into the garden, he'd been snappish and sullen since returning to the Temple of Perelandro. He'd flat-out refused to help prepare dinner or eat it, and after a brief, awkward attempt at a meal, chains had finally dragged him up to the temple roof. They sat there now, under the dying aura of false light, the hour when every visible inch of Elderglass in Camor threw off enough supernatural radiance to bring on a second sunset. Every bridge and avenue and tower was limned in eerie light, and beneath the steel-blue sky the city was a dark tapestry knit with 10,000 glowing stitches. The parapets of the temple's untended rooftop garden shielded lock and chains from prying eyes. They sat a few paces apart amidst the shards of broken pottery, staring at one another. Chains was taking unusually frequent drags on his sheaf of rolled tobacco, the red embers flaring with each indrawn breath.
"Look at me," he muttered. "You've got me smoking the Anacasti Black, my holiday blend. Of course you're still angry with me. You're about 7 years old, and your view of the world is this wide."
Chains held up the thumb and the forefinger of his left hand, and the distance between them was not generous. This, at last, drew Locke out of his silence.
"What happened wasn't fair."
"Fair? You mean to claim with a straight face that you buy into that heresy, my boy?"
Chains took a last long puff on his dying cigar and flicked the remnants into the darkness.
"Everyone in Catchfire dropped dead except for you and your fellow wolf cubs. In Shades Hill you avoided death for at least 2 grandiose mistakes that would have gotten a grown man's balls peeled like grapes, and you still want to talk about—"
"No,"
said Locke, his look of self-righteous annoyance instantly changing to one of startled embarrassment, as though he'd been accused of wetting his breeches.
"No, no, I didn't say those things were fair. I know life's not fair, but I thought you were."
"Ah," said Chains. "Well, now, I've always thought of myself as fair to a fault. Look, what are you more upset about? The fact that I lied about what had to happen to Sabatha, or the fact that the contest I rigged wasn't, as open to improvisation as you might have wished?"
"I don't know. Both. All of it."
"Locke, you may be too young for formal rhetoric, but you've got to at least try to pick your problems apart and explain them piece by piece. Now, here's another important question. Are you comfortable at this temple?"
"Yes."
"You eat well and sleep soundly. Your clothes are clean, you have many diversions, and you even get to bathe every week."
"Yes, yes, I like it a lot. It's all worth having to bathe, even."
"Hmm," said Chains. "You live long enough for your stones to drop. Then tell me if bathing is really such a hardship when the young women around you have bosoms that are more than theoretical."
"What? When my what?"
"Never mind. That subject will be sufficiently confusing in its own good time. So, you like it here. You're comfortable. You're protected. Have I behaved badly? Treated you as you were treated in Shades Hill?"
"Well, no. No, not like that at all."
"Yet none of that buys me any consideration in the matter of last night. Not one speck of trust. One tiny instant of the benefit of the doubt."
Oh, crap."
Locke made a desperate grab for eloquence and came up with empty hands, as usual.
"I don't mean... It's not that I don't appreciate..."
"Easy, Locke, easy. Just because you've been uncouth doesn't mean you might not have a point. But hear me now. This is a small home we live in. The temple might seem marvelous compared to living and sleeping in heaps of dozens, but believe me, walls squeeze the people who live inside them, sooner or later."
"They don't bother me," said Locke quickly.
"It's not so much the walls, though, Locke. It's the people. This will be your home for many years to come, God's willing, and you and Sabatha and the Sansas are going to be as close as family. You'll strike sparks off one another. I can't have you shoving your thumb up your ass and doing your best impression of a brick wall every time you get annoyed. Crooked Warden, help us. We've got to be ready and willing to talk, or we're all going to wake up with cut throats sooner or later.
I'm sorry.
Don't hang your head like a kicked puppy. Just keep it in mind. If you're going to live here, staying civil is as much a duty as sitting the steps or washing dishes. Now, while I bask in the glow of another moral sermon delivered with the precision of a master fencer, hold your applause and let's get back to last night. You're upset because the situation was contrived to give you only one real means of resolving it, short of curling up into a little ball and crying yourself into a stupor.
Yes, it wasn't like it would have been if they'd been real guards, if they weren't, you know, watching for me.
You're right. If those men had been real agents of the Duke, some of them might have been incompetent or open to bribery, and they might not have taken their duty to guard a little girl very seriously. Correct?
Yes.
Of course, if they'd been real agents of the Duke, they might also have taken her somewhere truly impregnable, like the Palace of Patience. And instead of 6, there might have been 12, or 20, or the entire Nightglass Company, prowling the streets looking to have an urgent personal conversation with you. Chains leaned forward and poked Locke's forehead. That's how luck works, lad. You can bitch all you like about how things could have been more favorable for you. But rest assured, things can always be worse. Always. Understood?
I think so, said Locke, with the neutral tone of a student gingerly accepting a master's assurances on something far beyond personal verification, like the number of angels that could play handball on the edge of a rose petal.
Well, if I can even get you thinking about it, that's a victory of sorts at your age. No offense.
Chains cracked his knuckles before continuing.
You, after all, have publicly vowed to never lose again, which is about as likely as me learning to crap gold bars on command.
But
let it be. I know your temperament, lad, and I'm too wise to try and give it more than a few sharp nudges at a time. So, the other thing. You're upset that I lied about what needed to be done with Sabitha.
Well, yeah.
You feel something for her.
I don't...
Quit it. This is important. You do feel something for her. There's more to this than a little wounded pride. Can you tell me about it?
Slowly, grudgingly, feeling as though he might be about to get up and run away, Locke somehow found the will to give Chains the barest sketch of his first encounter with Sabitha and of her later disappearance.
"Hells," said Chains quietly when the tale was finished.
The sky and the city beneath it had darkened while Locke had stumbled through his explanation.
"I can see why you snapped, having that rug pulled out from under you twice. Forgive me, Locke. I honestly didn't know you'd grown feelings for her in Shades Hill."
"It's okay," mumbled Locke.
"You have a crush, I think."
"Do I?"
Locke had a vague idea of what that word meant, and somehow it didn't seem right. It didn't seem enough.
"It's not meant to belittle your feelings, lad. A crush can come on hot and sharp like an illness. I know exactly what it's like. Years to go before your body will even be ready for, what comes between men and women. But a crush doesn't care. It's got a power all its own. That's the bad news."
"What's the good news?"
"Crushes fade. Sure as you and I are sitting here now. They're like sparks thrown from a fire, hot and bright for a moment, then gone."
Locke frowned, not at all sure he wanted to be released from his feelings for Sabitha. They were a bundle of mysteries, and every attempt to unravel them in his own mind seemed to send a pleasant warm shiver to every nerve in his body.
"Heh, you don't believe me, or you don't want to. Fair enough. but you're going to be living with Sabatha day in and day out any time one of you isn't away for training. My guess is she'll be like a sister to you in a few years. Familiarity has a way of filing the sharp edges off our feelings for other people. You'll see.
2. Time passed, days and months chaining together into years, and Jean Tannen joined the gentleman bastards. In the summer of the 77th year of Perelandro, 2 years after Jean's arrival, a rare dry spell came over the city-state of Camor, and the Angevine ran 10 feet below its usual height. The canals went grey and turgid, thickening like blood in the veins of a ripening corpse. Canal trees, those glorious affectations that usually roamed and twirled on the city's currents, with their long, flute-threaded roots drinking the filth around them, now bobbed in sullen masses, confined to the river and the floating market. Their silk-bright leaves dulled and their branches drooped. Their roots hung slack in the water like the tentacles of dead sea monsters. Day after day the temple district was shrouded in layers of smoke, as every denomination burned anything that came to mind in sacrifices pleading for a hard, cleansing rain that wouldn't come. In the cauldron and the dregs, where the lowest of the low slept 10 to a room in windowless houses, the usual steady flow of murders became a torrent. The Duke's corpse hunters, paid as they were by the head, whistled while they fished putrefying former citizens out of barrels and cesspits. The city's professional criminals, more conscientious than its impulsive killers, did their part for Camor's heir by throwing the remains of their victims into the harbour by night, where the predators of the Iron Sea quietly made the offerings vanish. In this atmosphere, in the hot summer evening heavy with smoke and the stink of 100 distinct putrefactions, the temple roof was out of the question for meetings, so Father Chains let his 5 young wards gather in the dank coolness of the glass burrow's kitchen. Their recent meals, by Chains' orders, had been lukewarm affairs, with anything cooked brought in from stalls near the floating market. They had come together that week as a complete set for the first time in half a year. Chain's interwoven programs of training had taken on the complexity of an acrobat's plate-spinning act as his young wards were shuffled back and forth between apprenticeships in assorted temples and trades, learning their habits, jargon, rituals, and trivia. These excursions were arranged by the eyeless priest via a remarkable network of contacts, extending well beyond Camor and the criminal fraternity, and they were largely paid for out of the small fortune that the citizens of Camor had charitably donated over the years. Time had begun to work its more obvious changes on the young gentleman bastards. Carlo and Galdo were dealing with a growth spurt that had given their usual grace a humbling dose of awkwardness, and their voices were starting to veer wildly. Jean Tannen was still on the cherubic side, but his shoulders were broadening, and from scuffles like the half-crown war, he had acquired the confident air of someone well-versed in the art of introducing faces to cobblestones. Given these evident signs of physical progress around him, Locke was secretly displeased with his own condition. His voice had yet to drop, and while he was larger than he'd ever been, all this did was maintain him in the same ratio as before, a medium child surrounded on all sides by the taller and the wider. And while he knew the other boys depended upon him to be the heart and brains of their combined operations, it was a cold comfort whenever Sabatha came home. Sabatha, who, if she objected to being the only gentle lady bastard, had never said so out loud, was freshly returned from weeks of immersive training as a court scrivener's apprentice, and bore new signs of physical progress herself. She was still taller than Locke, and the natural colour of her tightly plaited hair remained hidden by a brown alchemical wash. But her slender figure seemed to be pressing outward, ever so slightly, against the front of her thin chemise, and her movements around the glass burrow had revealed the hints of other emerging curves to Locke's vigilant eyes. Her natural poise had grown in direct proportion to her years, and while Locke held firm sway over the 3 other boys, she was a separate power, neither belittling his status in the gang nor overtly acknowledging it. There was a seriousness to her that Locke found deeply compelling, possibly because it was unique among the five of them. She had embarked upon a sort of miniature adulthood and skipped the wild facetiousness that defined, for example, the Sansas. It seemed to Locke that she was more eager than the rest of them to get to wherever their training was taking them.
"Young lady," said Father Chains as he entered the kitchen, "and young gentleman, such as you are, thank you for your prompt attention to my summons, a courtesy which I shall now repay by setting you on a path to frustration and acrimony. I have decided that you five do not fight amongst yourselves nearly enough."
"Begging your pardon," said Sabitha, "but if you'll look more closely at Carlo and Galdo, you'll see that's not the case."
"Ah, that's merely communication," said Chains. "Just as you and I speak by forming words, the natural private discourse of the Sansa twins appears to consist entirely of farts and savage beatings. What I want is all five of you facing off against one another."
"You want us to start hitting each other?" said Locke.
"Oh, I volunteer to hit Sabitha," said Carlo, "and I volunteer to be hit by Locke."
"I would also volunteer to be hit by Locke," said Galdo.
"Quiet, you turnip-brained alley apes," said Chains. "I don't want you boxing with one another. Not necessarily. No, I've given you all a great many tasks that have pitted you against the world, as individuals and as a group, and for the most part you've trounced my expectations. I think the time has come to pry you out of your comfortable little union and see how you fare in competition against one another."
"What sort of competition?" said Jean.
"Highly amusing competition," said Chains, raising his eyebrows. "From the perspective of the old man who gets to sit back and watch. It's been 3 or 4 years of steady training for most of you, and I want to see what happens when each of you tries to pit your zest for criminal enterprise against an opponent with a similar education."
"So, just to be clear," said Carlo, "none of us are going to be fighting Jean?"
"Not unless you're inconceivably stupid."
"Right," said Carlo. "What's the plan?"
"I'm going to keep you all here for the rest of the summer," said Chains. "A break from your apprenticeships. We can enjoy the marvelous weather together, and you can chase each other across the city, starting with..." He lifted a finger and pointed it at Locke. "You." "And," he slowly shifted his finger until it was pointed at Sabitha, "you."
Meaning what exactly?" said Locke.
Butterflies instantly came to life in his stomach, and the little bastards were heavily armed.
"A bit of elementary stalking and evasion on Coin Kisser's Row, tomorrow at noon."
"Surrounded by hundreds of people," said Sabitha coolly.
"Quite right, my dear. It's easy enough to follow someone when you've got the whole night to hide in. I think you're ready for something less forgiving. You'll begin at the very southern end of Coin Kisser's Row, carrying a handbag with an open top. Inside the bag will be 4 small rolls of silk, each a different color, easily visible from 10 or 20 feet away. You'll take a leisurely stroll up the full length of the district. Somewhere in your wake will be Locke, wearing a jacket with a certain number of brass buttons, also easily counted from a fairly narrow distance. The game is simple. Locke wins if he can tell me the colors of the silk. Sabitha wins if she crosses the Golden Reach Bridge from Coin Kisser's Row to 2 Silver Green without revealing the colors. She can also win if Locke is clumsy enough for her to count the number of buttons on his coat. Each of you wishing to report to me will have only one chance to be accurate, so you can't simply keep guessing until you get it right."
"Hold on," said Locke. "I get one way to win and she gets 2? "Perhaps you can try burning down the Golden Reach Bridge," Sabitha said sweetly.
"Yes, she gets 2, said Chains. "And fortunately for Camor, the bridge is made of stone.
Sabatha has a package to guard, and must, as I have said, move at a leisurely pace, with dignity. No running or climbing. Locke, you'll be expected to cause no scenes, but your freedom of movement will be less restricted. Ah, you're not to physically touch one another. You may not simply cover up the silk or the buttons. You may not have your opponent harmed or restrained in any fashion. And neither of you may call upon any of the other gentleman bastards for help.
Where do we get to be, then? Said Galdo.
Safely at home, said Chains, sitting the steps in my place.
Oh, balls to that! We want to see what happens!
One thing the contest does not need, said Chains, is a chorus of gawkers stumbling along for the duration. I'll be nearby, watching everything, and I promise to give you a very lively account upon my return. Now, he produced two small leather bags and tossed them to Locke and Sabatha, your operating funds. Locke opened his bag and counted 10 silver solons. You've got all night to think about what you're doing, said Chains. You may come and go as you please. Don't feel compelled to buy anything, but if you do, the coins I've given you are your absolute limit.
What's all this for? Said Locke.
To put you on the spot, and thereby...
I think, said Sabatha, he meant to ask, what's in it for the winner?
Ah, said Chains, of course. Well, other than acquiring a vast sense of personal satisfaction, the winner will hand their dinner chores over to the loser for 3 nights. How's that?
Locke watched Sabatha, and when she nodded once, he did the same. The girl already seemed to be lost in thought, and Locke felt a touch of apprehension beneath his rising excitement. He had every confidence in his own skills, as they had fetched him everything from coin purses to corpses without much difficulty, but the full extent of Sabatha's abilities was unknown to him. Her absences from the temple had been lengthier than those of any of the boys, and out there in the wider world she could have learned an infinite variety of nasty surprises. 3. Sabatha excused herself a few minutes later and vanished into the night, off to make whatever arrangements she thought were necessary. Locke followed in haste, throwing on the white robes of an initiate of Perelandro, but by the time he reached the hot, smoky air of the temple district's central plaza, she had long since vanished into the shadows. Might she be waiting out there, watching, hoping to follow him and learn what he was up to? The thought gave him a brief pause, but the unhappy fact was that he had no concrete plans at all, so it really didn't matter whether or not she dogged his heels all night. Lacking any better ideas, he decided to tour Coin Kisser's Row and refresh his memory of the district's landmarks. He hurried along with a brisk step, fingers interlaced within the sleeves of his robe, pondering. He trusted his clerical guise to shield him from inconvenience and harm, for he was keeping to better neighborhoods, and so he remained caught up in the whirl of his own thoughts as his feet carried him down the full length of Coin Kisser's Row, then back up again. The great counting houses were shuttered for the night, the bars and coffee shops all but empty, and the reeking canal had little of its usual drunken pleasure traffic. Locke stared at the monuments, the bridges, and the long deserted plazas, but no fresh inspiration fell out of the sky. When he returned home, somewhat discouraged, Sabatha had not yet returned. He fell asleep, still waiting to hear her come back down the glass tunnel from the temple above. 4. Coin Kisser's Row at noon lay sweltering beneath the molten bronze sun, but the upper classes of Camor had fortunes and appearances to maintain. The empty plazas of the previous night had become a lively pageant of overdressed crowds, which Locke and Sabatha now prepared to join. "I give you the field," said Chains, "upon which you two shall fight your mighty battle, wherein one shall stand tall, and the other shall end up with the dishes." Chains was ascending the unforgiving heights of fashion in a black velvet coat and pearl-studded doublet, with 3 silver-buckled belts taut against his belly. He wore a broad-brimmed black hat over a curly brown wig, and he had enough sweat running down his face to refill at least one of the city's canals. Locke was dressed far more comfortably, in a simple white doublet, black breeches and respectable shoes. Chains was holding Locke's jacket, with its telltale number of buttons, until Sabitha was sent on her way. For her part, Sabitha wore a linen dress and a simple jacket, both of a darkish red that was nearly the color of cinnamon. Her hair and face were concealed beneath a four-cornered hat with hanging gray veils, a fashion that had come rapidly back into vogue in the heat and foulness of recent weeks. Chains had carefully studied and approved these clothes. Locke and Sabitha could pass for servants dressed moderately, or rich children dressed lazily, and would be able to pursue their game without suspicion or interference, so long as they behaved.
"Well, daylight burning," said Chains, kneeling and pulling the two children toward him. "Are you ready?"
"Of course," said Sabitha. Locke merely nodded.
"Young lady first," said Chains. 20-second head start. Then uncover your satchel as we discussed. I'll be moving along in the crowd beside you, looming over your performance like a merciless god. Cheating will be dealt with in a thoroughly memorable fashion. Go, go, go."
Chains held fast to Locke's upper right arm as Sabitha moved off into the crowd. After a few moments, Chains spun Locke around, lifted his arms, and slipped the coat onto him. Locke ran his fingers up and down the right lapel, counting 6 buttons.
"I stretch forth my arm and cast you into the air."
Chains gave Locke a little shove.
"Now hunt, and let's see whether you're a hawk or a parakeet."
Locke allowed the push to carry him into the flow of the crowd. His initial position seemed good. Sabitha was about 30 yards away, headed north, and her cinnamon dress was hard to miss. Furthermore, Locke couldn't help but notice that the patrons of Coin Kisser's Row formed an ideal crowd for this sort of work, tending to move together in small, self-aware clusters, rather than as a more sprawling chaos. He would be chasing Sabitha down narrow avenues that would temporarily open and close around her, and even if she made good time, she wasn't likely to be able to hide in the blink of an eye. Still, Locke was as uneasy as he was excited, feeling much more parakeet than hawk. He had no plan beyond trusting to skill and circumstance, while Sabitha could have arranged anything. Or had she merely snuck off into the night for a few empty hours to make him think that she could have arranged anything?
"Gah!" he muttered in disgust, at least wise enough to recognize the danger of second-guessing himself into a panic before she even made her move.
The first few minutes of the chase were uneventful, though tense. Locke managed to close the distance by a few strides, no mean feat considering Sabitha's longer legs. As he moved, the peculiar chatter of the row enfolded him on all sides. Men and women blathered about trade syndicates, ships departing or expected back, interest rates, scandals, weather. It wasn't all that different from the conversation of one of the lower districts, in fact, save for more references to things like compound interest rates. There was no shortage of talk about handball and who was fucking whom. Locke hurried on through the din. If Sabitha noticed him creeping up on her, she didn't speed up. Perhaps she couldn't, not while staying dignified, though she did sidestep here and there, gradually moving herself farther and farther away from the canal side of the district and closer to the steps of the counting houses on Locke's left. Locke could see her satchel from time to time, hanging casually from her right shoulder, and it seemed that with perfectly innocent little gestures, she was managing to keep it mostly forward of her right hip, conveniently out of sight. Was that the game, then? Without using his arms or hands to directly conceal his row of brass buttons, Locke began making sure that his various twists and turns in the crowd were always made with his left shoulder turned forward. If Chains, occasionally visible as a large lurking shape somewhere to Locke's right, had any objection to this sort of mild rules-bending, he wasn't yet leaping out of the crowd to end the contest. Squinting, Locke spared a few seconds to glance around for unexpected hazards, then returned his gaze to Sabitha just in time to catch her causing a commotion. With smooth falseness that was readily apparent to Locke's practiced eye, Sabatha tripped into a huge merchant, rebounding lightly off the massive silk-clad hemispheres of his posterior. As the man whirled around, Sabatha was already turning in profile to Locke, curtsying in apology, concealing her satchel on the far side of her body, and no doubt peering straight at Locke from under her veils. Forewarned, he turned in unison with her, the other way, giving her a fine view of his buttonless left side as he pretended to scan to his right for something terribly important. Perfect stalemate. Locke was just too far away to hear what Sabatha said to the fat merchant, but her words brought rapid satisfaction, and she was hurrying off to the north again before he'd even finished turning back to his own business. Locke followed instantly, flush with much more than the day's stifling heat. He realized they'd covered nearly half the southern district of Coin Kisser's Row. A quarter of the field was already used up. Even worse, he realized that Sabatha was indulging him if she even bothered trying to count his buttons. All she really had to do was keep him stymied until she could dash across the final bridge to Two Silver Green. She continued veering to the left, closer and closer to a tall counting house, a many-gabled structure fronted by square columns carved with dozens of different representations of round-bellied Gandalo, filler of vaults, god of commerce. Sabatha moved up the building's steps and ducked behind one of those pillars. Another trap to try and eyeball his jacket? Tautly alert, carefully keeping his precious buttons turned away from Sabatha's last known position, he hurried toward the pillars. Might she be attempting to reach the inside of the counting house? No, there she was. Two of her! Two identical figures in cinnamon-colored dresses and long dark veils, with little bags slung over their right shoulders, stepped back out into the sunlight.
"She couldn't have," Locke whispered.
Yet clearly she had. During the night, while he'd been fretting up and down the dark streets, she'd arranged help and a set of matching costumes. Sabatha and her double strolled away from the carvings of the fat god, headed north toward the Bridge of the Seven Lanterns, the halfway point of their little contest. For all the opportunities he'd already seized in his short life to dwell upon Sabatha's every feature, both of the girls looked exactly alike to him.
"Tricky," said Locke under his breath.
There had to be some difference, if he could only spot it. The bags were probably his best chance. Surely they would be the hardest elements of the costumes to synchronize.
"Blood for rain!" boomed a deep voice as Locke re-entered the crowd.
Bearing down on him came a procession of men in black and gray robes. Their mantles bore emblems of crossed hammers and trowels, marking them as divines of Morgante, the city father, the god of order, hierarchies, and harsh consequences. While none of the Therin gods were ever called enemies, Morgante and his followers were undeniably the least hospitable to the semi-heresy of the Nameless Thirteenth. Morgante ruled executioners, constables, and judges, and no thief would willingly set foot in one of his temples. The black-robed procession, a dozen strong, was pushing along an open-topped wagon holding an iron cage. A slender man was chained upright inside it, his body covered with wet red gouges. Behind the cage stood a priest holding a wooden switch, topped with a claw-like blade about the size of a finger.
"Blood for rain!"
hollered the leader of the priests once again, and initiates behind him held baskets out to the passing crowd. It was a mobile sacrifice, then. For every coin tossed into a basket, the caged prisoner would receive another painful but carefully measured slash. That man would be a resident of the Palace of Patience, worming his way out of something harsh, judicial amputation, most likely, by offering his body up for this cruel use. Locke had no further thoughts to spare the poor fellow, for the two girls in dark red dresses were vanishing around the far left side of the procession. He ducked wide around the opposite side, just in case another ambush was in the offing. The girls weren't troubling themselves. They were headed straight for the Bridge of the Seven Lanterns, and were close enough that Locke dared not close the gap. While the bridge was wide enough for two wagons to pass without grinding wheel rims, it was narrow indeed compared to the plaza, with nowhere to duck and dodge if the girls tried anything clever. Locke matched their pace and trailed them like a kite, fading back to a distance of about 30 yards. Halfway to the end of the contest, and he hadn't actually gained a foot. The Bridge of the Seven Lanterns was plain solid stone, no unnerving toy left over from the long-vanished Eldrin. Its parapets were low, and as Locke moved step by step up the gentle arch, he was offered a fine view of dozens of boats moving sluggishly on the canal below, a view he ignored, focused as he was on the slender red shapes of his two rivals. There was no wagon traffic at the moment, and while Locke watched, the dress wearers separated, moving to opposite sides of the bridge. There they paused, each one turning her body as though she were gazing out over the water.
"Hell, shit, damn!" muttered Locke, trying for the first time in his life to emulate the lengthy chains of profanity woven by the few adult role models he'd ever had. "Pissing shit monkeys!"
What was the game now? Stall him indefinitely and let the sun cook them all? Looking for inspiration, he glanced around, and then back the way he'd come. A third girl in a cinnamon red dress and grey veil was walking straight toward him, not 20 yards behind, just at the point where the cobbles of the plaza met the bridge embankment. Locke's stomach performed a flip that would have been the highlight of any court acrobat's career. He turned away from the newcomer, trying not to look too startled. Crooked warden, he'd been stupid not to check the whole area where Sabitha had picked up her first decoy. And now, yes, his eyes weren't merely playing tricks. The two girls in front of him were slowly, calmly, demurely edging in his direction. He was trapped on a bridge at the center of a collapsing triangle of red dresses. Unless he ran like mad, which would signal to Chains and Sabitha alike that he'd broken character and given up, one of the girls would surely manage to count his buttons. Sweet gods, Sabitha had outwitted him before he'd even woken up that morning.
"Not done yet," he muttered, desperately scanning the area for any distraction he could seize. "Not yet, not yet!"
His vague frustration had flared up into a sweat-soaked terror of losing. No, not merely losing, but failing by such an astounding degree in his first contest against a girl he would have swallowed hot iron nails to impress. This wouldn't just embarrass him, it would convince Sabitha that he was a little boy of no account. Forever. As it happened, it wasn't fresh and subtle inspiration that saved him. It was his old teaser's reflexes, the unsociably crude methods he'd used to create street incidents back in his Shades Hill days. Barely realizing what he was doing, he flung himself down on his knees against the nearest parapet, with his brass buttons scant inches from the stone. With every ounce of energy he possessed, he pretended to throw up.
"Hook!"
he coughed, a minor prelude to a disgusting symphony.
"Hook! Hook! Blah!"
The noises were fine, as convincing as he'd ever conjured, and he pushed hard against the parapet with one shaking arm. That was always a great touch. Adults fell hard for it. Those that were repulsed would back off an extra 3 feet, and those that were sympathetic would all but tremble. He stole quick glances around while he moaned, shuddered, and retched. Adult passers-by were swinging wide around him, in the typical fashion of the rich and busy. There was no profit in attending to someone else's sick servant or messenger boy. As for his red-dressed nemesis, they had all halted, wavering like veiled apparitions. Approaching him now would be suspicious and dangerous, while standing there like statues would rapidly invite needless attention. Locke wondered what they would do, knowing he had merely succeeded in restoring a stalemate, but that was certainly better than letting their trap snap him up.
"Just keep retching,"
he whispered, and did so. As far as plans went, it was perhaps the worst he'd ever conceived, but now it was up to someone else to make the next move.
"What goes?" a woman's voice, brimming with authority. "Explain yourself, boy!"
That someone else was, as it turned out, wearing the mustard-colored jacket of the city watch.
"Lost your grip on breakfast, eh?"
The guardswoman nudged Locke with the tip of a boot.
"Look, just move along and be sick at the end of the bridge."
"Help me,"
whispered Locke.
"Can't stand on your own?"
The woman's leather fighting harness creaked as she crouched beside him, and her belt-slung baton tapped the ground.
"Give it a minute."
I'm not really sick.
Locke beckoned to her with one hand, concealing the gesture from everyone else with his body.
Bend down, please. I'm in danger.
What the hell are you on about? She looked wary, but did come closer.
Don't react. Don't hold this up.
In an instant, Locke had his little purse of silver coins, thus far unspent, transferred from his right hand to her left. He pushed the woman's fingers gently closed over the bag.
That's 10 solons. My master is a rich man. Help me, and he'll know your name. Gods be gracious, the woman whispered.
Locke knew that bag of silver represented several months of her pay. Would she bend for it?
What's going on? I'm in danger, Locke muttered. I'm being followed. A man wants the messages I carry for my master. Back on the plaza south of here, he tried to grab me twice. I'll take you to my watch station, then. No, there's no need. Just get me to the north side of this bridge. Pick me up and carry me, like I'm being arrested. If he sees that, he won't wait around. He'll go tell his masters the watch has me, and once we've gone a little ways, you can just let me go.
Let you go?
Sure, just set me down. Let me off with a warning. Talk to me sternly.
That'd look damned irregular.
You're the watch. You can do what you like, and nobody's going to say anything.
I still don't know.
Look, you're not breaking any law. You're just lending me a hand.
Locke knew he nearly had her. She had already taken his coin. Now it was a matter of notching the promised reward up a bit.
Get me off this bridge, and my master will double what I've given you, easily.
The guardswoman seemed to consider this for a few seconds, then rose from her crouch and seized him by the back of his jacket.
"You're not sick!" she yelled. "You're just making a god's damned scene!" "No, please!"
cried Locke, praying that he was, in fact, witnessing a purchased performance and not a sudden change of heart. The guardswoman lifted him, tucked him under her left arm, and marched north. Some of the well-dressed onlookers chuckled, but they all moved out of the way as Locke's improvised transportation carried him away from the scene of his near humiliation. He kicked and struggled to keep up his end of the presumed deception. Some of his squirming was only too real, as the woman's baton handle kept jabbing him in the ribs, spoiling what was an otherwise surprisingly comfortable ride. At least he was being carried with his all-important buttons facing the guardswoman's side. Locke scanned his tilted field of vision and saw, to his delight, that the two red dresses in front of him had darted far to the left and were keeping their distance from him and his temporarily tame yellow jacket. Would Sabitha believe he'd really been seized against his will? Probably not, but now she'd have to sort out a new plan of attack with her accomplices, whoever they were. His own plans were developing speedily as he pretended to fight back against his captor. Once he'd gotten well ahead of the girls, he could cut off their progress to the final choke point, Golden Reach Bridge. And while his ultimate position there would find him once again outnumbered 3-1, at least he would have more time to play spot the real Sabitha. Kicking, snarling, and shaking his fists, Locke was carried at last down the opposite side of the bridge, onto the northern plaza. Here the real powers of Coin Kisser's Row were situated, houses like Maraggio's and Bonaduretta's, whose webs of coin and credit reached out across the continent.
"Don't make me knock your teeth in!"
his guardswoman growled down at him as a particularly large group of onlookers moved past. Locke could have applauded her theatrical sense. Yellow jacket or not, the woman had good instincts. Now all they had to do was find a decent spot to set him down, and he was as good as—
"Oh, Constable, Constable, please wait!"
Locke heard the soft sound of running feet even before he heard Sabitha's voice, and he squirmed madly, trying to spot her before she arrived. Too late. She was at the guardswoman's other side, veil flipped back over her four-cornered hat. She was holding out a small dark pouch in her right hand.
"You dropped this, Constable."
"Dropped what?" The woman turned to face Sabitha, swinging Locke into position to look directly at her. Her cheeks were flushed red, and, inexplicably, she was letting her open satchel just hang there. Locke stared open-mouthed at the four tidy little rolls of silk tucked therein, red, green, black, and blue.
"You must be mistaken, girl." "Not at all. I saw it myself. I'm sure this is yours."
Sabitha pressed the little pouch into the constable's free hand, precisely as Locke had just moments earlier, and in so doing she moved closer and lowered her voice.
"That's 4 Solons. Please, please let my little brother go."
"What?" The constable sounded thoroughly mystified, but Locke noticed that she slipped the pouch into her coat with smooth reflexes. He was beginning to suspect that this yellow jacket had some prior experience with making offerings disappear.
"I'm sure he didn't mean to cause a scene," said Sabitha,
letting a note of desperate worry break into her voice.
"He's not supposed to be out on his own. He's not quite right in the head."
"Hey!" said Locke, suddenly realizing that knowledge of the silk colors wouldn't mean much if he let the situation spin further out of his control. What the hell was Sabitha doing?
"Wait just a minute!" "He's a total idiot," Sabitha whispered, squeezing the constable's free hand. "It's just not safe for him to be out without an escort. He makes up stories, you see. Please, let me take him home."
"I don't. I just... Now look here!" One or more wheels were clearly about to fly off the previously smooth-running engine of the guardswoman's thought processes, and Locke cringed. Suddenly, a wide, dark shape insinuated itself between Locke's constable and the cinnamon-red figure of Sabitha, gently pushing the girl aside.
"Ah, Madam Constable, I am so utterly delighted to see that you've retrieved the 2 parcels I misplaced," said Chains. "You are a jewel of efficiency, excellent woman, a gift from the heavens. I beg leave to shake your hand."
For the 3rd time in the span of a few minutes, a tiny parcel of coins slipped into the palm of the now utterly dumbstruck watchwoman. This exchange was fast.